The reading this morning will be taken from Genesis chapter 7, starting in verse 11 and reading through 19. Genesis chapter 7, starting in verse 11, reading through verse 19. In the 600th year of Noah's life, on the 17th day of the second month, on that day all the springs of the great deep burst forth, and the floodgates of the heavens were opened, and the rain fell on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. On that very day Noah and his sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, together with his wife and the wives of his three sons, entered the ark. They had with them every wild animal according to its kind, all livestock according to their kinds, every creature that moves on along the ground according to its kind, and every bird according to its kind, everything with wings. Pairs of all creatures that have breath of life in them came to Noah and entered the ark. The animals going in were male and female of every living thing as God had commanded Noah. Then the Lord shut him in. For 40 days and the flood kept coming on the earth, and as the waters increased, they lifted the ark high above the earth. The waters rose and increased greatly on the earth, and the ark floated on the surface of the water. They rose greatly on the earth, and all the high mountains under the entire heavens were covered.
I want to begin this morning by welcoming everyone here. We have some that are old friends that are with us. Glad that you're able to be with us this morning to worship the Lord. We also have some that are maybe new to some of us at least, and we're glad that you're here. And we want to encourage you to come back any time that you may have, because we want you to know that you're certainly an honored guest with us. I advertised this particular lesson last Sunday night. I think it's one that is terribly important to all of us as Christians. I know that I've mentioned this before, but I'm going to emphasize it again. There are those out there in the world that call themselves not just atheists, but anti-theists. And they would tell you that for you to believe in the Bible is to be no more than to be believing in, say, Grimm's fairy tales, or maybe some old wives' tales, or maybe some other similar fiction, something that you know to be fiction. Like maybe you're no different than anyone that would believe that the earth is flat. There's an individual named Richard Dawkins, and major proponents of anti-theism or atheism, wrote a book called God Delusion, and he makes no bones about it. You believe in God? You're just deluding yourself. You're fooling yourself. Richard Dawkins said the idea about the earth is young, about it being young and only a few thousand years old, is, quote, a preposterous and mind-shrinking falsehood. You have a little mind if you're going to believe in a young earth, is essentially what he's saying. Another fellow, Christopher Hitchens, says, I do not envy believers their faith. I'm relieved to think that the whole story is a sinister fairy tale. In other words, you're an idiot to believe a single word of the Bible. And you're to be pitied because your mind is so small. And so that has an effect upon us as Christians. whether we realize it or not. Because these same ideas frequently, subtly, some usually, are propounded in the media. Scanning through the channels here a long time ago. Came to a show, and they started talking about the Jesus myth in passing. Well, they mentioned it in passing. Oh, okay. So if you believe in Jesus, you believe in a myth. And you say, well, it's just really in passing. But it reinforces the same idea. And our friends as well wind up succumbing to this even more, probably even more so. And it becomes embarrassing to admit, perhaps, when we're among them, yeah, I do believe the Bible. Or perhaps it kind of wears away at us and we begin to feel like, well, maybe there's something to all that evolution after all. Maybe there's something to this idea that the earth really isn't quite as young as the Bible makes it out to be. What we're going to do this morning, I hope, is to look at a scientific explanation of creation and also the flood. An attempt to bolster the faith of everyone here, in an attempt to reinforce the idea that maybe those that want to proclaim the idea that there is no God, they're the ones that are believing in a fairy tale, and not those that believe in God. I'm also going to confess that much of what we're going to talk about this morning is not going to be focused that much on the Scriptures, although we are going to look at the Scriptures some. Because we're going to look at what one man has written and proposed about how the world was created and how the flood could have indeed happened. And we're going to focus mostly on that in an attempt to try and to bolster the faith of all of us and not feel like you have to be an idiot to admit that, yes, I know that the flood's in the Bible, and just kind of mumble away the conversation. Embarrassed as you've been identified as a Christian. Instead, you can boldly say, yes, I believe the Bible. We're going to begin this morning by looking to see just exactly what it is the Bible says about the creation and with respect to what it's going to pertain to this morning. We don't have the time to study all of creation, what the Scriptures say about the creation, nor do we have the time to study everything about the flood. But rather, we'll try and zip through this as quickly as we can. Let me also say, this is a very, very complicated and very, very broad subject. So as I begin to get into explaining this man's concept and this man's idea, it's possible I may not have the engineering training to be able to explain this. But this is going to broadly deal with mechanics, physics, structural analysis, all kinds of physical properties that you can possibly imagine. And it's going to deal with subjects that I must confess, I'm still trying to get my arms around. Let me show you. This is the book that we're talking about here. It's a guy named Walter Brown. He has a PhD from MIT. Now, that's a fairly good school. Maybe not as good as the one I went to, but it's a fairly good school. And he has proposed this idea. He's written this book. You can see it's a fairly thick book. And it has lots of illustrations and lots of explanations. You do not get your arms around this in one or two days. Now, I must confess, I didn't get this just recently. I've had this for some time. But it's still very, very broad. The best illustration I can think of is this. I don't believe there are very many of us here that thoroughly understand the workings of a car engine. There are some that may have a pretty good idea, but have a thorough understanding of it. And that's fairly complex, especially nowadays. Consider the entire Earth and how the complexity of how that would have behaved during a cataclysmic flood. And the forces involved and the science required to understand all aspects of it is mind-boggling. And yet he goes into each one of those areas and he answers all types of questions. The book is available to anyone that would like to review it. The book is available online. I can get you the website. And online, I mean, you can go and you can look online, and it has everything that is in here, all the diagrams, all of the illustrations that are in here, word for word, the same text. And you can, and in fact, that's where I got many of the illustrations that we're going to use this morning. Let's begin to see, just point out a couple of things about the flood, or about the creation, that are going to be germane to and once again, somehow the header not being on here is Becky's fault. I don't know how, but somehow it is. But we note here, it will come up. In Genesis chapter 1, verses 6 through 7, the waters are separated by an expanse. And I put expanse in quotes here. Let's just read Genesis chapter 1, verses 6 through 7. God said, "Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. And God made the expanse and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse." Now, some of your translations may make this firmament. Some may make it the heavens. This particular Hebrew word is sometimes used in conjunction with to indicate the heavens, because it's usually joined with under the heavens. But in this particular instance, that Hebrew word appears by itself, and some translations show it as firmament. And if you read this and you want to say, okay, the expanse is the heavens, so you've got the water above the heavens and the waters below, which are the seas, it really kind of doesn't make that much sense. But what if you say, understand that there's water above, and then there's a firmament, and then there's water below, okay, we can maybe kind of make sense of that. We know there's underground water. So we'll go from there. I told you it would show up. Creation, on day 3, we look at the next couple of verses 9 and 10. The waters under the heavens are gathered to one place. And God said in verse 9, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas, and God saw that it was good. Now, what he's going to wind up, we're going to look at this here, and we're going to see just exactly how he understands these in the creation of the world and how that led to the flood. Let's go on to the flood then and look at what the scriptures teach us about the flood. First of all, if we look in verse 11 of where Dan read to us a while ago, the fountains of the great deep burst open. What could that possibly be? Verse 11, we're still there. The windows of the heaven were opened, and it started to rain. it rained for 40 days and 40 nights, according to verse 12. And then we note that all flesh that was not in the ark died. We also need to note, and I left off of here accidentally, if you look at verse 20, that the waters wound up being 15 cubits over the mountains. Wow. Some of you know Mount Everest is pretty high. That's a lot of water. How is that possible? We're going to get to that. One of the other things to note is, if we look in verse 24, that the water continued to rise for 110 days after the rain stopped. Wow, that's something interesting. So it's no wonder then that many of the atheists, those that don't want to believe in the Bible, they read many of these things that are talked about here, and they say these are incredible. How is it after the rain after it stopped raining, 110 days later, the water is still rising? How is that possible? Where's that water coming from? And so there are just various things about this that they look at and they say, this is just really preposterous. It's a myth that somebody thought up, and it made kind of sense to them, but when you really, in today's scientific world, it doesn't really make that much sense. We'll make it make sense. We will show how it could easily have made sense. Most of you have seen this before. This is also noted by Walter Brown, Walt Brown in his book. This is a Chinese word for large ship. It is composed of three different other Chinese words. This one is a boat, a vessel. This one is for the number eight, and this is people. The Chinese language goes back to 2500 BC as a minimum. It is an old, old language. How is it we wind up with eight people denoting a huge boat? Now, this is not proof, by no means. Don't misunderstand me. And I'm saying, oh, there you go, there's your proof. But it is more than coincidental that here is an ancient language that says that a large boat can hold eight people. Where did the number eight come from? The other thing we want to note is, when we talk about the ark, is many people want to make it out to be a huge ship. And it's got a nice bow to it, and it has a nice stern, and it's made as if it's going to be going, and that's not at all what the word ark means. The Hebrew word for ark means it's a box. Remember what it was? They put the tablets with the Ten Commandments on, and they carried around with the Hebrews in the wilderness. Was called the Ark of the Covenant. It was not a ship, but rather it was a big box. And this was a big, big box. This is his illustration of a football stadium, and it's to show that this was like 300 cubits long, like 450 feet, and it was, I believe, 50 cubits wide. So you can put a lot of animals in here, and you can put a lot of food to be able to last for some time. And that's what it was that God said, and it also explains why it took Noah a bit of time to be able to construct this thing. And that this is a more accurate rendition of what the ark would have looked like. Now, we're not going to go into, but I want to mention just briefly the idea about evolution. Evolutionists want to tell us that the world is really, that the universe is billions of years old. There are problems with that. And there are problems with evolution. One of the things as you begin to look at with evolution, some of it, I believe Dan's class may have been looking at this. This illustrates microevolution. You can have lizards that are small, some are big, some of them develop different colors. That's microevolution. Macroevolution, which is what the evolutionists want to tell us, is how we came to be, is a lizard eventually turns into a roadrunner. The problem is, we go and look at the fossil records, you just don't find any of these, they have yet to find any intermediary animals in the fossil records. Oodles of these, but they don't have anything in between. Why? There are a lot of other problems. He lists over 40 problems in his book with evolution. I'm just going to note a few of them here. I'm going to try and do it as quickly as I can. Acquired characteristics. I used to have a lot better muscles than I had. If I'd had a son, there's no way I could have passed my bigger muscles onto my son. So any kind of characteristic I may have developed as a part of perhaps microevolution, I'm not going to be able to pass that on in macroevolution and pass that on to any descendants of mine. But yet, that's what evolutionists want to tell you. That this animal developed this character, this capability, and they pass that on to their offspring. Another aspect is the idea of fully developed organs. And a good example of that is wing. You don't find any fossil records with a partially developed wing, nor do you find a partially developed eye. There are some organs that secrete fluids, and they go through a duct of some kind or a tube. What happens if a tube just gets partially developed during evolution? Guess what? The animal dies. So that characteristic can't be passed on. There are all kinds of problems with that. You've got the idea of distinct types. That is that there are no animals that have some characteristics of a completely distinct animal. You don't see cats that look kind of like a dog at all. You just don't find that kind of. You have some animals that are similar that are one another, but they're not going to find animals that seem to be shared characteristics. Two-celled animals, they haven't found any. Nor have they found any 3, 4, or 5-celled animals. It jumps from 1 to 6. And yet, if evolution were a fact, you'd be finding evidence of 2, 3, 4, 5, because you got to go from 1 to 2, and then to 3, and then you've got to go at least from 1 to 2 to get to 6. Another one is symbiotic relationships. Some of you understand what I'm talking about on this. There is the yucca plant. It depends upon the yucca moth. Without the yucca moth, it dies. There's fig trees. They depend upon the fig gall wasp. There are bees. How about bees? You don't develop the bees, or you develop the plants, and then where are the bees? You got to have the bees to pollinate the plants, or the plants die off. And even within the bees, there's worker bees and queen bees. And you can't have them develop slowly. All of them have to be working to doing the same thing. Metamorphosis is another one that's impossible. In the case of a larva, you have a chewing mouth. The animal, when it comes out, will have a sucking tube. The larva will have few simple eyes. Then when it comes out as a mature animal, after more metamorphosis, it'll have 2 compound eyes at least. Some of them very, very complex. The larva has no legs. When it comes out of the metamorphosis process, it has six segmented legs. The larva can't reproduce, but yet the metamorphosis animal can. There are all kinds of problems with evolution. And when you begin to point out a lot of these problems, then the answer you usually get is, well, we just don't have enough information. And as we begin to get more science and more information, then we'll get these answered. Here's what usually happens. We get more information, we've got more questions and more problems that are discovered. When Charles Darwin first proposed his theory of evolution, it seemed like there were a few problems. He recognized the problems with the organs. And as time has gone on and science has further developed and we see just how complex even one-celled animals are, we understand that there are even more problems with evolution than those that support it would suggest. So what is it then that we want to suggest about the creation? How was it then if the evolutionist is incorrect and the earth is young, only several thousand years old, how is it the Lord could have created the world in such a way that the flood could have happened? Well, he calls this idea his hydroplate theory. And we want to start, before we begin to look at that, just to make sort of a notice, or not, a review here. This is a cutaway view of the earth. Note this thin portion here is the crust. This is the mantle, and then you've got the outer core, which is liquid, and the inner core, which is solid. This distance from here to the other side is about 7,900 miles. That means that this distance from here to here, in the middle of this ball right there, is about 4,000 miles. That means that these are very, very small. This is not to scale, this crust right here. So we're talking about extremely, extremely large distances here to get down to the mantle. The crossover depth, I can explain that to you. Let's just let it go for now for the sake of time, because I had really planned to be much further along by this at this point in time. What he suggests is that in the day of on the creation, and this is what happened on day two, and you go back and you read the Genesis account, that you had the water that was above a crust. Then there was also subterranean water that was also confined, and that this distance had about 3/4 of a mile of depth of water above, and then about 60 miles of crust, and then underneath that, less than a mile of water in the mantle. And what happened was, on the second day, you have this settling here, and you have some areas where the mantle begins to get thick, and other areas where it gets thin, and because of physics, you're going to have some of the land will come up out of the water on day three. This is where the earth was created, and then some of it will reach down and touch the mantle here and become what are called pillars. And this is illustrated also as to what the earth would have looked like before the flood, that you had granite here and then up to 3/4 of a mile of water here underneath that, and then you had a pre-flood sea. And then one of the other things to note, by the way, the land here the crust was fairly level. That the mountains, any mountains that would have existed before the flood, were a few thousand feet at most. And by that I mean 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 feet, something like that. Not very tall at all. And so what you're talking about then with the flood and the floodwaters being 15 cubits over the land, you're not talking about nearly as much water as you would today with the Himalayas. Now, where do the Himalayas come from? We're going to get to that. We're also going to look at where the Grand Canyon came from, if I can zip through this quickly enough. But one of the things to note to support this idea, going back to this picture here, note the pillars or where it dips down and touches the mantle area here. We look at Psalms 36, by the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and the breath of his mouth, all their host. He gathers the waters of the sea together as a heap. He lays the deeps in storehouses. Psalm 104, verse 3, he lays the beams of his upper chambers in the waters. He makes the clouds his chariot. He walks upon the wings of the wind. The beams of his upper chambers would be those pillars that were labeled or demonstrated there earlier. I include this next picture in here. I pulled this off of the internet from an article. This is the world's deepest hole. It's on the Kola Peninsula in Russia. And according to the article here, it started in 1970, and they just started drilling. They got down to 7.5 miles, and what they found was that after about 20 years, they were dealing with almost 400 degrees Fahrenheit at that depth, and it made it impossible for the tools to keep going, and they abandoned it in 2008, but they bolted the hole shut so nothing could get in or out. But the man has made an attempt, but they've only gone down about 7.5 miles into the earth. What, given this sort of an arrangement, what you had was with the, I want to go back and what you had before the flood, you would have the earth as it turned, you would have tidal effects, just like you do today. And as the earth turned and the moon and the sun pulled on it, you had this being pulled up and then pulled down, and over time this water became what they call supercritical, meaning it was under tremendous pressure and it was extremely hot. Upwards around, they figure around 700 degrees Fahrenheit or 400 degrees C. And because it was under this pressure and it was that hot because of this back and forth, a lot of this pressure begins to build up. And so eventually, what happened was that that at some point the crust of the earth split. And what you had then was what we now see. If you look at the in the ocean pictures of the ocean floor, you see this seam that just kind of goes around the world like the seam of a baseball. And it would have started at one point and gone in both directions at the rate of about 3 miles a second. And it would have traveled about 46,000 miles. Notice here that it goes here and then it splits and it gets to here and it forms a T. And this indicates that this split got here first and then this one got here later. And so it stopped. What he proposes is that because of the water under pressure down below, supercritical water, that what happened was this thing ruptured and it produced a giant, you can call it a fountain, when it ruptured. And all of this water got pushed up. It was hypersonic in speed. It was not supersonic, it was hypersonic. This was under such pressure that he contends that it took dirt and rock from here and it threw it up into the air. What happened was that the water, as it shot up, some of it would fall back as rain. Some of it got high enough to where it froze and fell back as hail. Some of it reached escape velocity and was thrown out into space. And that this is where our comets and our asteroids come from. And that all that's going on with these is they're returning back to the Earth. As evidence of this, I mean, it's not just mere speculation. The book is full of information, evidence, scientific evidence that backs this up. They have found in asteroids they've been able to, or meteorites they've been able to collect, bacterium. It's suspended of some kind, but it's bacterium. Where in space is bacteria going to form? There's no way. It's cold. And he contends that it formed here on Earth, and it was a part of what was shot up into the air during the flood. Furthermore, you have instances of animals that were frozen in the middle of doing something. Mammoths in Siberia. They have one mammoth. It still has food in its mouth that it was eating. Undigested, which means it froze like that. What could possibly have done that? And the answer is a tremendous amount of hail having fallen that would freeze the animal instantly. There is a report, it's not been documented fully. There's a report of in Russia, they were making a road and they cleared away some dirt and they found a frozen riverbank with fish in it. Water when in a river freezes at the top and then the water can continue flowing underneath. How is it then that fish could, that the water would freeze with the fish still swimming in it? And the answer is, if suddenly it's full of hail, it would freeze from the bottom up. Large amounts of ice that would suck all the heat out of the water and freeze it. Another report, again unconfirmed, but that of water buffalo or yaks, I believe, that were swimming across a river and they were frozen while they were swimming across the river. So that would be supported by the idea, that would substantiate the idea that perhaps some of this went really high into the air, froze, and fell back as hail. The water, this is going to throw water and debris upwards. Some of the water is going to fall as sun, rain, some of it's going to fall as muddy hail. The water is going to trap plants and sediment into the sediment, and this is where we get our fossils. This is also where we get our fossil fuels, and some of the water is thrown into space as comets, asteroids, and meteors. So then this is going to proceed to the flood phase where it's going to rain, and remember what's happened is that this water has created this huge gap here by cleaning all or clearing all of the mantle off by this really fast water shooting up. And so what happens is it creates, this water is not nearly as heavy as the crust. And so it's going to create a bulge here. And this is an example here, is the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. And this would be Europe sliding off. And this would be the North American, South America sliding off. And they begin to this continental drift phase. This is something that lasts about a day. Because what's going to happen is, as these things slide in each direction, what's going to happen is this water here is going to be pushed out, and they act as a lubricant, and they're going to get to a point to where they're going to grind to a halt. And what happens then, they grind to a halt, and that forms then the mountains that we know of, the major mountains today. So if you look at a map, where are the mountains in North America and South America? The major ones, they're on the west coast, because those land masses were sliding away from the Mid-Atlantic Drift. They ran out of water, they hit that mantle, and they stopped. And when they stopped, they began to settle into the mantle here. And this phase continues to the present. Then, there are all kinds of things that happen as a result of this, and he goes into a lot more detail. Here's an example of mountains in British Columbia. This is rock. You cannot do this with rock. Only if this is fairly soft like putty can you do this. And the only way that can happen is with the forces that would occur with this, during the flood phase. And it caused these to just buckle and bend like this. And it all happened then as the mountains ground to a halt. The Himalayas were formed the same way, that it was as they ground to a halt. And here's a summary of the time phase of various things that would have happened during each of these phases. And the recovery phase, again, as he points out, continues today. It's going to involve earthquakes and volcanic activity, which we still have today. And as he points out, you could say every earthquake that we have today is still a result of the flood and an effect of the flood. So the question now we want to come up with and to look at very quickly, how did we get the Grand Canyon? That's something that's, to me, a very fascinating question. One of the things we want to note is how plateaus form. There's a Tibetan Plateau. The Tibetan Plateau is over 3 miles high. It's next to the Himalayas. And the way that we get it is, again, a very simple physics property, and that is the fact that when you have any kind of a piston-like situation pushing down on a liquid, that it's going to be able to push similarly elsewhere. So you have the mountains that were formed that when they stopped, they began to sink into the mantle. And when they did, they pushed up the land around them straight up. And that's where the plateau, this would include the Colorado Plateau. So when that happened, then you took flood waters with them that would have been still in existence. And so what happened was you wound up with a couple of huge lakes that were formed. Here's a map. Here's the four corners right here. Here's the state of Colorado. Here's Utah. Here's Arizona. And here's New Mexico. He calls these Grand Lake and Hopi Lake. I don't know if he named them or if somebody else has named them. But here is Grand Lake. It's huge. And then Hopi Lake is another one. What his contention is that the Grand Canyon was not formed over hundreds of millions of years, as evolutionists want to tell you, but rather it was formed in just a few weeks. How did it happen? Well, after several thousand years, this area right here weakened and it drained the Grand Lake all of a sudden. And it eventually widened over here to where it breached the area holding the Hopi Lake, and it too drained. And we're going to, as an idea of how much water we're talking about, this is Monument Valley. Here's the far edge of Grand Lake. I don't really know where all of this is. If this is looking, here's Monument Valley here. If it's looking at this area here, if it's looking at this area here, or if it's this area, look into this area, I'm not real sure. But whether it's just here or whether it's looking all the way over to here, the point is that's a lot of water that would hold. That is a lot of water there in Monument Valley. He talks about how these were formed, how the mesas and the buttes were formed. I'm not going to go into that. I'm already out of time. And here's again another picture of how it would have happened. One of the things to ask those that want to say that the Colorado River did this over several hundred million years is, how did this happen? If the Colorado River's cutting through here, what caused this deep? That's a huge amount of dirt that's one washed away. Where did this go? They don't have an answer for that. Where's the dirt? If it happened slowly over several hundred million years, it would have been an awful lot of dirt. This is a map of the Mississippi River Delta. The thing we want to note here is the Mississippi River comes out here and it has formed this huge delta out here, whereas you slowly bring that dirt down the river, it slowly then begins to form the land mass out here. So you would expect to, similarly, if you're talking about 200 million years with the Grand Canyon, you'd have to find something at least this big here at the mouth of the Colorado River. This is what we find instead. Very smooth. And you don't find this huge amount of landmass out here that one would expect. And somebody says, well, that looks kind of like a delta. This is not nearly enough dirt. They calculate it was 2,800 cubic miles of dirt that went out of the Grand Canyon and the surrounding area. And this hasn't even begun to match it. Where's the dirt? It's out here in the underwater. It's out here in the Gulf. Got washed way out here in a very fast method. Here's another thing that you would find. These are boulders. You would expect to find that something cataclysmic happening like this, that is going to have these rocks that are tumbled and smoothed over time. Over the distance as they get washed down the Grand Canyon. These particular boulders, exactly what you would find, and in fact, they are about a mile east of the Colorado River. They are about 100 feet above the Colorado River, they're near Bullhead City. And I imagine you can go out. He's got a pin here that shows the relative size of these boulders. That's exactly what you would expect if this was a cataclysmic event that all of a sudden, in a matter of a few weeks, washed all that dirt and all that rock out of the Grand Canyon very quickly, that all this would be cast up high on the banks. That is just the tip of the iceberg. I want to point out this is just one man's idea of what the flood could have been like. It's one man's idea of how the earth was created. I need to emphasize the fact we don't have any eyewitnesses to the flood, nor do we have any eyewitness accounts of the flood. So this is to be taken with not as absolute, but it's just one man's idea. But it answers so many questions in the Bible. It answers the issues that so many skeptics have tossed into the face of believers. And it answers so many other questions much better than what other ideas man has come up with to explain various phenomena in the world today. We need to note that there are things about the creation and about the flood we're never going to completely understand. And if they really, really are interesting to you, then all I can say is you can ask God about it when you get to heaven. But we need to also note that whatever our understanding, it must agree about the Bible. We cannot go off and say, I know that's what the Bible says, but I want to believe this over here. That tosses out ideas like theistic evolution. Tosses out a lot of other ideas that man wants to believe in because it's convenient or because he doesn't want to have to stand before somebody else and defend the idea that he is a believer. Finally, I want to note that being a believer does not mean that you have to take off your head and become an absolute idiot because you believe in the Bible. And that's exactly what so many individuals, in the way of skeptics, want to tell you, that if you're going to believe in the Bible, that you just forget about all. It's not rational. It goes against everything. I want each of us to be able to leave here with the confidence that we can stand up to those that are do not believe in the Bible, and say with confidence, yes, I believe the Bible is true. That we can be like the Apostle Paul, as he wrote in his second letter to Timothy, chapter 1, verse 12. I'm not ashamed, for I know whom I have believed, and I'm convinced that he is able to guard until that day what has been entrusted to me. Brothers and sisters, friends, visitors, we need to have absolute confidence in the fact that the Bible, every word of it, is true. That God did exactly what He said He did, and He did it in the manner in which He said He did it. We may not understand it completely, but as time goes on and man uncovers more and more scientific evidence, it only agrees with the Scriptures. It does not refute it. And we need to develop a lot more confidence. We need to have more backbone when confronted by individuals that say, no, I really think you're silly for believing in the Bible. And learn to be able to have the information you need to be able to turn that around and say, okay, there's some things about the skeptics and their theories I don't understand. Here's some things about evolution. You all accept it as fact. Explain this to me. Explain that to me. And when they say, well, we just don't understand enough yet, say, you know, I've heard that all my life. And every time we get more information, all it does is just present more problems with the idea of evolution. We need to be able to live our lives as an exclamation point, not as a question mark. Are you here this morning and you're not a Christian? Maybe you've been held back by the idea that you're not convinced about the validity of the Bible. Maybe you've been worried that, well, you know, I just don't want to give my life over to a fairy tale. Now you're thinking, perhaps this is something that, you know, I can take confidence in this. And I realize now that I stand condemned before God, and I need to have my sins washed away. We stand ready. We want to encourage you this morning, if you would, to come and confess Christ and be able to put on your Lord in baptism. We want to encourage you to do that. Perhaps you're an individual that you have been a Christian and you just haven't lived your life as you ought to because maybe perhaps doubt has crept in. And now you want to make a new change in your life. You need the help of the congregation here. We want to help you. We'll pray with you, help you in any way that we possibly can. We invite you to come to the front as we stand and sing that song that's been selected.